Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk, and we are coming to you live from downtown Austin, Texas. Yeah, there we go. We've got a big Texas-themed show for you today. Will Texas be a battleground state in 2020? Oh, they already have an answer. I guess we'll cancel that segment. It's the age-old question the media loves to ask, and we are going to address it head-on this evening with a special guest from Austin. Also, what's going on with Texas's presidential contenders? It's early days, but both Julian Castro and Beto O'Rourke, two young, seemingly promising candidates, are having some difficulty lifting off. So why aren't they doing better? We're also going to play a round of trivia, and get ready, audience, because you are going to play with us. However, before I go any further, let me introduce this fabulous panel sitting next to me. We have Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
Hello, Austin.
And Senior Politics Writer Claire Malone. Hey.
Hey, Galen.
Oh, shit. Wow.
Hey, y'all. And Managing Editor Micah Cohen. And we've actually been in town for a couple days already, so if you catch any y'alls or Texas twang...
That's why we're casually going to drink on stage.
Why we're casually drinking on stage. We're basically Texans now.
Speak for yourself.
And I'll also say that tonight's live show is part of our 538 on the Road series, which is sponsored by WeWork. And our next stop is Houston, Texas on Wednesday. So if you don't have your tickets yet, head to 538.com/live to get them. That's mostly for the listeners at home. However, if anybody here in Austin also wants to come see us in Texas, I think we have like one or two seats left in the rental. So they're yours if you want them. So we're going to spend plenty of time talking about Texas, but we're going to begin with the most important news of the day, which is, anybody?
The royal baby.
The royal baby, absolutely. So, Nate, have we published our baby name forecast yet?
I am not a fan of this topic.
Any guesses? Any forecasts?
I have one. I have a guess.
You have one?
Albert.
Albert. Okay. Micah had a guest backstage.
Perennial betting favorite, by the way, Albert.
Albert. Hank?
Hank?
Hank would be a good name.
Real name Henry?
No, just Hank.
Sure.
All right, so in earnest now, let's begin with Texas's presidential contenders. They are, of course, former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and former Mayor of San Antonio, Julian Castro, and former Congressman from El Paso and darling of the 2018 midterms, Beto O'Rourke. So, Claire, set the scene for us. Where do those two stand in the field right now?
I think we have what we're citing the latest Quinnipiac poll as our sort of gold standard poll right now. I think Julian Castro has been polling steadily at about 1% for most of the time that he's been in the race. But the latest Quinnipiac poll puts Beto O'Rourke, the last time that Quinnipiac did polling in late March, he was at about 12%. In this latest version, he's at 5%. So he's taken a dive. They're both doing not so hot. Again, it's like 18 months until the presidential election, so who knows? I mean, I think maybe part of O'Rourke's deal is like he's looking for that next sort of viral moment, or he's hoping that he can be a workhorse in Iowa, whatever. But they've both kind of been just sort of coasting along the past few weeks.
I mean, is it fair to say that they're doing poorly? I mean, is it too early, or are there too many people in the field to really make that judgment?
No, look, I think they should not be grouped together necessarily. I think Beto is clearly underperforming expectations. And he did get like a little bit of a bounce after he declared. That's kind of when the Quinnipiac poll was conducted. But like
he raised a lot of money.
He raised a lot of money. He's at 4 or 5 or 6%, which is not good. But it's also good for like fifth or sixth place. And so for him, you can still see some paths back. The most obvious one being that he does have a lot of money. Therefore, he has more runway. He does campaign a lot, jumps up on a lot of tables and so forth. But his path back would be, hey, gradually you win over voters in Iowa, and you see the shift in Iowa where all of a sudden he's at 8, 9, 10%, and then that changed the conversation about him a little bit. So, whereas Castro never really had any type of liftoff at all to begin with, never got very much media coverage, never has gotten much more than 1%. I think only recently actually hit the 65,000 person donor threshold, which O'Rourke hit in a day. So I put Beto in this kind of middle tier of candidates with like Cory Booker and Amy Klobuchar, people who kind of, you can see how things would go right, and they're not going right now. Castro was, I think, a tier behind that, where like he would have to have some breakout to get into like the waiting off stage tier and then have some further moment.
Okay, so why is that? Why aren't they doing better?
Well, I would ask the crowd. I mean, something's wrong with Texas, clearly. You guys can't out good candidates.
I think Castro suffers from the fact that he kind of had essentially two full years off from any national attention. He served in the Obama administration, but the past, you know, the Trump era has given a lot of attention to Washington Democrats. So people who are senators, who are making news in front of TV cameras, because we now all see congressional testimony as appointment viewing. So Kamala Harris had her really big, I mean, frankly, like, I think she probably fully decided to be a presidential candidate in part because she thought, listen, I got a really great organic response from those hearings, I should run. Castro kind of suffers for having been completely out of the cycle. And, you know, he had his moment of what a rising young star a decade ago, let's say. So he's a little bit, he kind of came in this uncomfortable middle ground period of the Democratic Party under Obama, where, you know, he was going to be a star of the future, but now all these people are kind of skipping forward, and you only have to serve in the Senate for a couple of years before you run for president.
Well, look, O'Rourke is certainly a tier above Castro at this moment, but if I were O'Rourke's campaign, I think I actually might be a little more worried than Castro's campaign. Because he came into the race, got a lot of attention, raised a lot of money, and sort of had a chance there to put a flag in the ground, get some support. And now you've seen his support dip, where Castro hasn't really had his chance yet. Now, maybe he'll never get it, but like Castro hasn't been rejected by voters yet.
Well, but look,
wait, so has O'Rourke been rejected by voters? I mean,
some,
is it, can we say that at this point? Like,
yeah.
It's over.
No, and if you look at the favorability ratings for Beto, they're about the same as they were. They've always been steady, right? At about, you know, 45 or 50% favorable, 10 or 15% unfavorable, and then 30 whatever percent no opinion. Some of it is that the media turned away from him as the more interesting story. We can debate why that is. I think it's partly because, like, I don't know, he doesn't have maybe as interesting a message as some other Democrats. You also have a field where you have the two candidates who have been leading the polls are straight white men. And so I kind of wonder, I mean, I still wonder at some point something's going to reorient itself where people of color and women, I can't imagine a race where you don't have more prominence for some of those candidates. And he's not someone who would benefit from that. And
I think
so,
he suffers also from Buttigieg's virality.
And Mayor Pete. We haven't mentioned Mayor Pete yet. But yeah, no, I was not joking, right? I was like at a bar on a taco crawl in East Austin the other day, right? And like this guy, like who I did not know who I was, right? Like pointed at a Beto sticker.
Finally, Austin, a place where Nate Silver can be anonymous.
And he's like, I like Pete Buttigieg. He actually said it like that in kind of a very deliberate Buttigieg way, and just kind of said that to the bartender. It was like kind of a biker-looking dude, which is an interesting constituency. But in Austin, I guess it's weird. But clearly, like, if you already have the white men as a group, frankly, getting more votes than they will in the long run, and you have another white man, although a gay white man, who surges, then that, I think, would affect things as well.
He also, I mean, I think he's been a little bit behind the ball as far as having moments, right? So there are a couple things, like, he hasn't had a CNN town hall yet, right? So, like, that's a way that, like, Buttigieg, you could see the fundraising bump that he got from that. He hasn't had a moment, like Warren said, let's abolish the Electoral College, let's impeach Trump. O'Rourke has kind of been like Harris almost in the kind of way of like, I'm going to equivocate a little bit, see which way the winds are blowing, and then maybe I'll take a stand.
Right, he just recently said that he's for impeachment now.
Right, so he hasn't really been kind of forging a path in any way. He hasn't been blazing a path, which is, by the way, kind of how he won Texas, right? He was a palatable moderate who went all over and was not Ted Cruz, right? And that's how, I mean, that was a lot of what he had to do. But I think he's kind of in this weird space right now with, what, 20 other people, where it's like, well, what's he doing right now? What's he done for me lately is kind of like
So do you think it was the circumstances of the 2018 Senate race in Texas that made Beto Beto more than something that is special about him specifically?
Too early to tell.
Well, I think it was. I think it has to be a little of both. I think it's a little too cruel to take all the credit away from him. I think he ran a good campaign. You know, he may not be to the taste of some people, but clearly he's to the taste of a lot of people. He's raked in a ton of money. And look, like Claire's point, it is incredibly early. If the O'Rourke campaign, the Castro campaign, or the Harris campaign, if they're there saying to themselves, let's play the long game, we don't want to make a ton of news yet, we're still however many months out, that's not a crazy strategy. We're not to the first debate yet.
That's a big one.
Maybe they're waiting for the first debate to sort of like, maybe that's when the Texas candidates will finally make their mark.
I think we'll talk in the Texas turning purple segment. I think what he did in 2018 was quite impressive. That if you adjust for the partisan lean of the state and the fact that Cruz, not the most popular incumbent, but still an incumbent, then his margin was quite good to only lose by 3 or 2.7, whatever it was. And the fact that turnout was so much higher, I think, is pretty impressive. So that's a reason to be optimistic about him. And another reason might be that, like, I think he kind of realized, like, I don't need to, like, have a whole blitz of attention right now. I'm kind of pissing into the wind a little bit with the Mayor Pete surge and the attention around Biden, who got as much coverage last week as all other Democrats combined. But I tell you what, you know, we've been in this business a while, and like there are going to be like 5 or 6 more times probably when a candidate surges. And the question is, who has staying power when they surge? I don't think there's any rule that says you can only surge once. In 2012, we saw like Newt Gingrich surge like 3 times, I think. And, you know, Senate is like kind of this like thing where who has the resources to stay in longer, which is good for Beto, who is most likely to have a breakout moment at a debate. Again, this is maybe my taste. I might say he's not one of the most likely, but it's more subjective, obviously.
Yeah, but debates aren't really debates, and they're mostly ways for candidates to sort of get out portions of their stumps each and like other candidates interrupt them. And I could see Beto actually potentially being good at that. No, I'm serious. I mean,
Claire, if I can interrupt for a second.
I think the thing that's so weird about the way American political candidates quote unquote debate is that you were a debater. It's not actually, you're not actually really getting any sort of substantive. What?
Sat up a little straighter there. It's like, yes,
well, in high school debate, we like talk really fast. And so I still probably talk,
but like
pretty fast as a permanent
candidate goals in those debates, especially like the first one, like the 20-person hootenanny, is just to kind of like say something for a couple of minutes that makes people think like, what a nice guy. And maybe that's, I mean, honestly, the other thing is like O'Rourke's team could be a little bit gun shy about all of the sort of blowback for the Vanity Fair stuff, and maybe that's why they haven't done a CNN town hall. Like they might be laying low a little bit.
So we've talked plenty about O'Rourke. To wrap up, at this point, we talked about Castro's actually his theory of the case when he announced. What would he have to do right now to gain traction nationally, or at least in a couple states that make people take him seriously?
I don't think it takes a lot, actually. I think, like, we were actually talking at lunch today that it like, in terms of 2020, it's kind of been a boring couple weeks, maybe 2-3 weeks. And so it doesn't take that much to have a moment. You know, with Buttigieg, it was a town hall. And Castro is really interesting. You know, one of our writers, Perry Bacon, did a piece about Castro's, you know, a major Latino candidate in a Democratic Party where Latino voters are a huge part of the electorate. And you sort of think to yourself, well, that should work. But then you look through it through Democratic primaries past, and Latino voters have never really coalesced around a candidate in the way that, like, Black voters have, for example, behind Clinton in 2016 or Obama in 2008. And the comparison Perry made, which who knows if it'll happen again, but I think it's telling, is early in 2008, like 2007, you know, Black voters were more split between Obama and Clinton. And it really took Obama winning Iowa and more generally just doing well before you saw Black voters go wholesale, not wholesale, but, you know, more overwhelmingly behind him. So I do wonder with Castro if he can get a moment.
The argument being that you have to first prove that you're electable before kind of your maybe natural constituency as far as identity goes
jumps on board fully.
Yeah, and look, there is research that shows all else being equal, this is like research in city level races, statewide races, that Latino voters will vote for a Latino candidate over other candidates, again, all else being equal. But yeah, you know, if you were a black voter in 2008, you wanted a little evidence that, hey, this guy is for real. There had never been a black major party nominee. If you're a Latino voter now, I think you're waiting a little bit for evidence that this guy's for real.
Yeah, so like South Carolina was Obama's proving ground to a certain extent with black voters. So maybe Castro has to wait till Nevada, which is a little bit, I think Perry makes this point in his piece. Nevada's a bit far down the primary calendar. I mean, not super far, but enough that people build media coverage momentum. They win primaries, and if he has to wait for that state, that could be a little bit like too long.
I mean, the good news if you're any candidate not named Biden is that the race for second is currently pretty wide open, where you've had Bernie fall to like 15 or 16%, and I don't think a super strong 15 or 16 given his name recognition. And so I don't know. So who can form a good contrast with Biden? And maybe Castro can formulate a better contrast with Biden than some people can. You know, in part because he can say, hey, look, I'm I'm from Texas, turning purple. Maybe that conveys some electability advantage. I think Hispanics have been totally ignored in coverage of the campaign for the most part so far, and they are like something like 15% of the Democratic electorate and are important this year given how forward Nevada, Texas, and California are in the voting process. So, you know, it's kind of like who will have the opportunity to make that claim? I don't know if it'll be him, but if he gets there, then he can form a contrast versus Biden, whereas Beto, I'm not quite sure as much. They both are probably in the more moderate half of the field. Although one last thing about Beto is, like, he does take a lot of positions that I think reflect the fact that he did represent a majority district, where he talks about education more than most candidates. On issues of, like, racial justice, he is often quite liberal, more than on, like, economic issues. And so there is, like, some coherence there. But it's all kind of weird. I mean, I feel like all the pundits, including us, like focus so much on what the 60% of Democrats who are white think and believe, and not as much on what the 40% who are non-white think and believe. And certainly for Castro, but also maybe in some ways for Beto, because if you're going for younger voters, younger Democrats are more likely to be minorities. Like, can he gain traction with Hispanic voters or black voters?
All right. Well, of course, time will tell, but for now, let's move on to everybody's favorite topic, which is, will Texas be a battleground state in 2020? But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. In fact, we are recording this podcast live from WeWork's 600 Congress location in Austin. This was their very first location in the state of Texas. They now have over 20 across the Lone Star State, including in Houston and Dallas. It's part of WeWork's growing network of workspaces across the U.S. and the world. A few exciting new openings in 2019 include Salt Lake City, Phoenix, and Las Vegas. WeWork pays special attention to reflect the energy and history of a neighborhood through its workspace design. The interiors of this location, for example, were inspired by Wes Anderson's Austin Roots. Its windows pay homage to the music culture in Austin. And WeWork's dedicated community staff, like Sophie and her team here at 600 Congress, will make moving in a breeze and ensure minimal disruption to your team's workflow. Whether you're a team of one or 100, they've got your back. So enjoy the complete peace of mind knowing you can expand or contract your physical workspace without constraint, given WeWork's flexible membership options. All day-to-day operational needs like IT, maintenance, and cleaning are handled by WeWork, allowing you to focus 100% of your time on building the future of your business. Head over to WeWork.com to find a location near you and learn more about WeWork's custom workspace solutions for larger teams. On to the next part of the show, and for this, we actually have a special guest joining us, and that is Ashley Lopez, the senior politics reporter at KUT Austin. Come on up, Ashley. Let's give her a round of applause. So welcome, Ashley. I also want to give a big shout out to Ashley for helping us explore the East Side Austin bars this weekend. She was very key in our experience this weekend. So again, thank you. All right. I want to begin by just letting everybody lay out their position. We're going to get into a lot of the different details about demographics and the 2018 midterms. But just to start, relatively briefly, we'll start with you, Ashley. Is Texas a battleground state in 2020?
Well, it's going to be the closest version of that maybe in 2020. I know that's a cagey answer, but every time people act too confident about that, they're wrong. At least in Texas, they have been. So, I mean, because it's a presidential election compared to 2018, there's going to be more Democratic-leaning voters voting. But it's still Texas. I mean, Beto's margin was the closest there was in 2018 out of all those races. But, like, Republicans still won all the statewide races. Like, I just don't see it changing that much. So I'm going to give you a cagey answer and say it's going to be the closest thing to a battleground state in 2020. Yeah.
All right, Nate?
So there are different ways to answer. Micah, your looks.
Galen, did you envision this as a quick... Yes.
No.
People listening to this podcast can't see Micah's dirty looks here.
I was trying to give you a preemptive dirty look. Okay. To try to shorten the answer.
So there are six different ways that could be considered a battleground state, and then there are A, B, and C for each one.
Okay. So one question is, can a Democrat win Texas for president in 2020? And the answer is yes, if a Democrat wins by like an Obama in 2008 margin by 7 points nationally or something, or 10 points, then Texas is probably very competitive. Could Texas be a tipping point state, as we call it, meaning the decisive state in a close election? I think the answer is probably not. In 2016, Hillary lost it by 9 points, I think, mm-hmm. in an election where the tipping point state was Wisconsin, where she lost by 1 point. So it's about 8 points more GOP than the tipping point. Obviously, demographics are changing. I mean, I talked to my one of my Lyft drivers, very Tom Friedman.
Oh, Jesus.
Anecdote said, said y'all are supposed to have 2 million more people in the metro area within 20 years. You have a lot of people who are migrating here. You have the white population getting more liberal. By the way, one thing about Beto is that he didn't actually have spectacular Hispanic turnout. So there's a scenario where you have kind of the white suburban vote and the Hispanic vote. If they both were to click for Democrats, there's a kind of enough Democrats for a Democrat to win.
Okay, so what's the answer?
The answer is it's probably the 10th or 11th most likely state to be the tipping point state.
We're going to get into maybe a little bit more about the circumstances that would make it a battleground state. Yeah. But first, let's let Claire and Micah get in on this.
No, I don't think Texas is a battleground state in 2020. I'll keep it short and sweet. I think that all of the scenarios that you guys have laid out are definitely true. But if you're thinking about, like, you know, the last couple of weeks of a campaign, I don't think Texas is going to be one of the places where, you know, a Democratic presidential campaign is going to waste a lot of resources, particularly given 2016. I think that 2016 hangover of losing the quote-unquote blue wall in the upper Midwest, Pennsylvania, I think that'll loom too large for Texas to actually become a true battleground state next year.
Micah?
I think we have some Midwestern bias showing here, and they're just clinging to their, you know, swing region. I think, yes, it will be a battleground state.
Ooh! Are you just doing that for the applause?
Define how.
I think the candidates and parties will make serious investments into the state and battle over its electoral votes and House seats. And so, you know, no, honestly. Like,
I think he might have just won that one, actually.
Yeah, you're already seeing this, like, the parties are making more of an investment in Texas relative to the other states than they used to. Does that mean it's going to tip the election? Probably not.
Here's a question. Does Texas's battleground status in 2020 depend on who the Democratic nominee is?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay, so there. We're all right.
Yeah. Everyone's right. Everyone gets a prize.
Wait a second.
All right, but before we get into more of 2020, let's look back at 2018 for a second. Of course, Ashley, you were covering that race. Why did Beto O'Rourke close the gap to 2.5 points when Greg Abbott was winning by 13 points and George P. Bush was winning by 10 points? Like, what is it about that race that got the margin below 3 points?
Beto O'Rourke ran a better race, especially compared to Lupe Valdez, who ran as a Democratic governorship candidate. She did not have as strong a campaign. That's one thing. Yeah, I mean, and he traveled the whole state. I mean, he says it all the time. I'm not even going to quote him because he said it so often. He traveled all the counties here. He engaged with young voters, which is something candidates don't usually do. Like, he did a tour of colleges, which I don't see politicians do often because that's, like, not a good place to put your time and money because they tend not to vote in high numbers like other constituencies. And then it was also the moment, right? Like, there was bluish blue wave. That was a good time for a lot of Democrats to run for office. So, and demographics have been changing in Texas. You know, we talked about white college-educated voters. The suburbs are getting urbanized in Texas, so that helps. So I think it's a lot of different things, but the reason why Greg Abbott won and won by such a big margin compared to Ted Cruz was because Beto O'Rourke, I think, just ran a better campaign.
Did it feel different, like on the ground? Were you like, oh, something's happening?
Yeah, I mean, and it started really early. So I don't know if a lot of people were here for like the very beginnings of that race. Like it started with like, I noticed that he was getting traction because I saw stickers on iPads and coffee shops. Like he had like this brand of being like an underdog. And, you know, he started off like, you know, not really popular, but he had some flashpoints, some moments, and it started growing. Now, I'm not saying like that's going to replicate itself, but it was different. I didn't see people as engaged, especially on the Democratic side, as early as that race.
I mean, talking about the difference between, say, how Lupe Valdez did and how Beto O'Rourke did, it kind of becomes obvious that some Republican voters, people who at least vote for Republicans for the governor's race and perhaps previously voted Republican, decided to vote for Beto O'Rourke. So what kind of a Democratic candidate in 2020 replicates that? Gets maybe moderate voters, people who have voted for Republican, maybe voted for Mitt Romney, voted for the Bushes, all of a sudden are going to vote for a Democrat.
Hillary did fairly well in Texas relative to previous Democratic presidential candidates. So it's probably not a candidate who is too far to the left. It's certainly not a candidate whose appeal is limited only to white voters, because that won't be enough.
It could be Biden, right? I mean, because...
I don't know about Biden. Well, maybe. I mean, if you think Biden's more electable, whatever, right? But like with Biden, you're kind of... With Biden, it's so explicitly about, like, kind of the northern path, where you're going to Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. And if Biden can't win those states, then Biden's candidacy is probably going poorly.
Biden, I mean, this is black voters. Biden has a decent amount of support from black voters. He's hired some very high-profile black Democrats. You know, Simone Sanders was Bernie Sanders' campaign spokesperson. I saw he just announced a bunch of Nevada hires. I mean, there is a possibility that he could be like, all right, listen, I'm going to take this very seriously. This is my sort of Achilles heel, and I'm going to build this out.
Can I drop a good use of polling, bad use of polling bomb on this conversation? Emerson just released a poll last week that did head-to-head polling in the state between the Democratic candidates and Trump. And there was one Democratic candidate who came out ahead of Trump in the polling. It was Biden. Then Beto was tied. And then Bernie Sanders was 2 points behind. So maybe you don't like head-to-head polling this far out, I understand, but let's maybe like add that to the conversation. You're saying maybe not Biden, but it seems like he would be doing the best in head-to-head polling right now.
With Texas, you have to be very careful, because the universe of like all Texas adults versus Texas registered voters versus likely voters are different things. And it really is about, like, if everyone turns out in Texas, then it looks like a purple state, right? If the more traditional voters turn out only, then it's a red state. And so, I don't know, you know, I would think someone like Kamala Harris would be more of kind of a Democrat trying to turn out more new voters, and that means you're competing more in Texas and probably also Arizona and maybe also Florida, right? I mean, again, there are these two paths where Democrat, if they were to win back these Midwestern states, and we count Pennsylvania as part of the Midwest for political purposes, right, then that suffices. But I would think that, like, Kamala or Booker or Beto, because he's from here, would be more of like a Southern strategy, so to speak, candidate.
I guess I do wonder a little bit in terms of Democrats being able to get over the line. Ashley, I'd be curious what you think. You know, the Democratic Party is diverse enough where it's fairly hard to appeal to like many different constituencies at once. And so in 2018, for example, what finally got O'Rourke so close wasn't what everyone thought it would be in Texas forever, which was the Hispanic vote. It really was that kind of suburban, college-educated white voter, which in response to Trump or whatever, swung hard towards Democrats. So part of me thinks, probably any candidate could. Trump is still going to be on the ballot in 2020. Any candidate could do relatively well. But putting that together with the Hispanic vote is probably what it would take. And I don't know if you have a sense of, like, which candidate has the best chance of doing that in Texas? That feels hard to me.
Yeah, Beto underperformed in South Texas, where there's a lot of Hispanic voters. And so that shows me that maybe his first name isn't as powerful as his last name. Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other thing. Sorry. That's a tough one. The other thing is that Hispanics have been underfunded in terms of like how campaigns spend their money. They don't get talked to directly or well. Campaigns tend to be very white, so they don't know how to reach out in a really effective way. So I don't think anyone knows how to do this well. And also, it takes a lot of money to grow an electorate or to change an electorate in Texas, because registering, but we have very low voter participation, very low voter registration, and registering voters here is really expensive. This is not a place where we have online voter registration or an automatic registration. You got to have a stamp, some ink on some paper, and it takes a lot of time and money. And it, you know, rules about like who can register voters are really strict here too. It's not easy. So I don't think anyone has properly funded, intelligently funded a vote, a get out the vote campaign among Latinos in the state or in most of the country. So I mean, who's good at that? I don't know. I haven't seen evidence of anyone being really good at that. And I know that sounds kind of mean. Well, you know what? Florida had some pretty good examples. I would say like Rick Scott, who the Republican who won there, had like a dedicated campaign. You know, a good example might also be John Cornyn in 2014 had a dedicated, and he won the Hispanic vote. A Republican in Texas won the Hispanic vote in 2014.
And like from here on the ground, like what does the outreach look like? Because like we've talked a little bit about, well, Hispanic communities, there's lots of different reasons for why they're less politically active. But like what does that mean, like when John Cornyn was really good at having Hispanic outreach?
Oh, he had Spanish language ads. Like I'm not saying that's like the marquee, like how people should reach out to Hispanic voters, but he tried, which is more than like a lot of Republicans are doing now, from what I can tell, of course. Right now, I know groups are, there are like several groups that have started beefing up and asking for money and getting to work on registering voters. Texas is so big that it's hard to know if that's a drop in the bucket right now. So,
but see, this is part of why I think it could be a battleground, is like so much of this low-hanging fruit hasn't been even attempted to picked yet, that if and so much excitement has been generated in the Democratic Party by Trump that...
But couldn't she... Wasn't that Hillary Clinton's argument in Arizona?
She came close in Arizona.
Sure. But people thought it would be... People thought the Hispanics would be... The turnout would be so much higher because Trump was on the ballot. Now, maybe 4 years of Trump makes Hispanics that much more likely to turn out, but... That wasn't necessarily, like, their predictions didn't necessarily come true, that Trump would agitate people.
I think Arizona, especially given 2018, is definitely like indisputably like a swing state and like a core swing state, like one of the five or six most important. Texas has a lot of electoral votes. How many is it? Like 36 or something, or 38? It's probably going to have 41 or something after the next census. At some point,
Is Arizona a swing state because of white college-educated voters or because of Latino voters?
I think a mix, right? I mean, look, I think the perfect candidate for Texas or Arizona, a perfect Democrat, would be like a moderate black or Hispanic Democrat. And there aren't a lot of those, right? But in theory, if you were kind of constructing a candidate in a lab, that candidate could do very well, potentially. But there are so many electoral votes here that's kind of lumpy, the math of all of it. And at some point, unless Texas becomes a purple state, then Democrats have a lot of problems. Because, like, if the vote gets more more rural... So one thing I've done is look at... Let's say that everything was purely determined by urban versus rural status. And then we have some, like, fairly sophisticated ways to designate what's rural and what's urban. So it's not just the way the Census Bureau does it. If you do that, Texas comes out as a state that should be purple. Or maybe even a little bit blue-leaning. And so if you have more and more of a situation where Democrats do well in cities and higher density suburbs, and Republicans do well in rural areas and lower density exurbs and suburbs, then Democrats really need Texas to make up for the fact that they're not going to win a lot in the upper Midwest. They're not going to win Wisconsin and Minnesota as often under that scenario. They're not going to win Maine and New Hampshire as often under that scenario. And you get to a point where you kind of need Texas for the math to work in the Electoral College for Democrats.
Okay, so that brings us to a good question to start wrapping up on, which is, we heard from the Democratic Party of Texas and the DCCC that they are focusing on Texas in 2020. They think that six House seats they can flip. you know, they're putting resources, of course, into the Senate race, and they're talking about it as a battleground state in 2020 on the presidential level. At least that's what the party is talking about. Now, of course, they're going to say, we're fighting the fight no matter what. We have yet to see how many resources they actually put into the state, et cetera, et cetera. But is that a good strategy? If Democrats were to go all in on Texas in 2020, would that be a mistake? Let's start with you, Ashley.
No, because unlike, I guess, a lot of those other states we talked about, like, this is a very young population comparatively, so this is always going to be a better investment. Right now, the Hispanic population, like, a third of it is under 18, but they won't always be. Like, I don't know, in terms of long-term planning, and I know politics isn't like that, it's all about, like, kind of short-term gains, but going all in, I'd say, like, go pretty hard in Texas. Like, maybe don't put all your eggs in that basket. And also, there are a lot of flippable seats. I mean, for the DCCC, that's a different question. There are seats that are going to be pretty flippable here. And I'm thinking here in the Austin area, that out of the 6-3 are in this area that they're targeting, you know, they're going to have to defend Allred and Fletcher's seat. So that's going to be already kind of hard. But there are a lot of opportunities here. I'd say why not? Sure.
Yeah, just to endorse Ashley's comment, I mean, from a House perspective, from a DCCC perspective, Democrats picked off most of the low and the medium hanging fruit last year. And the one place where they kind of might have been scratching their heads a little bit and were like, oh, could we have won 2 or 3 more seats with more investment was here in Texas, where a lot of seats that were not expected to be competitive wound up being kind of close, right? That Will Hurd seat, which at one point he was up by 15 points, right, wound up being a, what was it, like a 1-point race. So, and there's a Senate race, too, next year. So you would think the DCCC would be urging Democrats a lot to campaign here and compete here. I mean, look, I agree with Micah that, like, you're probably going to see, for various reasons, including posturing in the media narrative, you're going to see probably Democrats claim in June and July and August that Texas is a swing state, and there'll be some, like, PPP poll that comes out that has a nominee, you know, 1 point behind Trump. People get excited. And then people realize that, okay, as the race shifts back and forth, at the times when Trump is doing relatively well, that Texas fades into the background a little bit. And then when he's in trouble, then it becomes more competitive, and people will realize, like, oh, gradually kind of pull resources out. That's like the modal scenario, I think. But for lots of reasons, including the Congress and the long term, you probably have to, like, start out making some investments here.
But that's, like, the lesson from 2016, right? I'll agree with him. But, like, I'll steal this from you, which is, I mean, one of the reasons why we talked about Trump was a surprise is because he made investments and made plays in places where people laughed at him for making investments and making plays. But in the end, it got him the presidency. And it surprised him as well as everyone else. But, like, I think that is a really interesting lesson of politics, which is, like, you know, conventional wisdom can kill, you know, and I think that that's, so the idea that you would invest in places that aren't naturally your constituency is smart.
So, Michael, we have plenty of examples for why it is a good investment for Democrats, good strategy to go hard in Texas. I'm going to actually ask you the reverse question to wrap things up here. What should Republicans do to stem their losses in Texas? What would be a good Republican strategy to counter with?
I mean, it's both easy and hard. It's easy in the sense of it's not a mystery. Republicans in Texas used to do much better with non-white voters and with college-educated voters. Think of the, you know, George W. Bush. Yeah. And what did he do? He, like, made outreach efforts and did speeches in Spanish and English and did, like, really, to Ashley's point, like, really basic stuff. Now, even if they did that now, actually, didn't the gubernatorial... Didn't Abbott did some of that too a little bit in 2018. And so that kind of basic stuff I do think makes a difference. Now, while it's happening under the umbrella of Trump, I don't think it's going to do them much good. But nothing in politics is permanent. If I were, you know, a Republican operative in my mid-20s right now, thinking about the next several decades, I would be thinking about How do we get back aligned with non-white voters in Texas and college-educated voters in Texas? And, you know, don't say racist things. no, but that sounded flip, but, like, honestly, I didn't really mean it flippantly. Like, you know, just some basic stuff I think would go a long way. And then there are, I mean, I actually don't know a ton about Abbott, but there is some ideological diversity in the Republican Party. So maybe just lean into that a little bit.
The idea of, like, what would you do if you're a young Republican strategist is a really interesting question. And I do actually think that there's a lot of open road for both Democrats and Republicans, but perhaps particularly Republicans, to answer the questions of, we face a changing economy with automation. Republicans are going to provide some sort of answer because we are the party of business and we want to help American innovation. Like, I think that there's a lot of roads you could go down that way. Young people are maybe not traditionally Republican, but there's a decent constituency of libertarians in younger people. Like, that is a streak that I think is growing in American life. And I think if you are a young Republican strategist, like, those are interesting roads to pursue. But you would have to say that, like, the Republican Party itself would have to change from the party of Trump, which it is right now. It's not Mitt Romney's Republican Party right now. But there are, I think, people who are certainly hiding a little bit in the background because it is currently the party of Trump, and they don't want to make waves.
And just to echo a point Claire made a few weeks ago, you know, it does feel a little bit like between college-educated voters swinging left and the Latino vote, people are starting to make investments there. That's overwhelmingly Democratic. Maybe as you know, engagement among Texas Latinos starts to increase, it does feel a little bit like, oh, this is sort of inevitable. And Democrats need this in terms of the Electoral College. But, like, those are two groups that don't necessarily, this is the point Claire made, that don't necessarily have all that much in common in terms of where they live, in terms of their interests. And so if you're a Republican in Texas, not only are you okay right now, but there's, like, a fair amount of room for you to maneuver, I think.
And I will just close out saying, like, Texas Republican, like, strategists at least, don't even agree on whether they should care about, like, Hispanic voters in the future right now, because they're winning white voters so handedly. And, like, look at the last election. Like, yeah, Beto O'Rourke came close, but he still lost. So, yeah, I'm just going to leave it there.
All right. Well, we are going to leave it there. Thank you so much, Ashley. Round of applause for Ashley. Thank you so much. All right, and now it is time for a little fun. We're going to play a round of trivia. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans through thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address. It's ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Great job, Galen, with those ads. Round of applause.
Galen reads above his grade level.
That's not easy, you know. I had to do it. It's hard. Yeah.
Although I'm jealous that I didn't get the same wine break that you guys got.
Hey, have some wine.
Yeah, I'll get to it. Maybe somebody can pour me a glass. Yeah, thank you.
Can I just make a shout out? Someone is wearing a Decision Desk t-shirt up in this front row, which shout out to Decision Desk. Great
That's
t-shirt.
Very cool.
You know it's our crowd when you see a Decision Desk t-shirt. Sorry, Galen.
I love it. All right, now on to some trivia. Our topics are the 2020 primary and Texas. It's a mix, so I hope everyone picked up as much Texas political knowledge as possible over the past couple days. And as I mentioned earlier, the audience is going to play with us, so here's how this will work. I will ask Nate, Claire, or Micah a trivia question. If they get it right, they get a point. If they don't get it right, the audience has a chance to steal. However, listen closely, because the first person to shout out the answer is the person who gives the answer for the entire audience. So unless you really know the answer, maybe don't say it.
This proves Everybody that Galen was never like a babysitter or camp counselor.
You got to work together. One answer.
One answer. So let's begin with the first question to Nate. We'll just go down the line. According to first quarter FEC reports, which presidential candidate raised the largest percent of their cash from small donors? And that is $200 or less.
I was afraid you were going to make me actually name all the candidates, which I think I could do, but I'm not totally sure.
Oh, that's a good one. Maybe I'll add that, actually.
It was Bernie Sanders, right?
All right. Audience?
Andrew Yang.
Yes. Audience gets one point. 1 point for the audience.
Come on, that was obvious, man.
So far, the audience is winning. 1-0-0-0. And yes, it was Andrew Yang. 81% of his donations came from small donors. For Bernie Sanders, who was second, it was 74%. So congratulations. All right, Claire. When was the last time Texas went for a Democrat in a presidential election?
Don't whisper it. We can hear you up here, guys.
1972?
Very close. All right.
1976.
All right, and that is another one for the audience.
Oh, my God. This was a bad idea to let them play.
All right, it is audience 2, Nate 0, Claire 0, Micah 0. Let's see if Micah can put something on the board for a 538er.
Jesus.
According to the Nevada Independent, which 2020 candidate has made the most trips to Nevada?
I'm going to say...
Collusion.
Collusion. It's become us versus them now.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know. I have no idea. So I'll go with Elizabeth Warren.
Wait, no. The audience gets the opportunity now.
Sorry, man.
Claire really f***ed me up there.
Was it all a strategy?
That's what I was going to say.
That's right. The audience has 3 points.
I thought it was too obvious.
So that is Julian Castro with 7 visits.
How many rounds of this are there?
We got like 6 more questions, so like 2 more rounds.
So have we been mathematically eliminated?
Maybe they'll be worth more as we go on. It's us versus them. Okay.
Let's actually do that.
Okay, so last minute change in order to make this interesting. Nate, how many times in U.S. history has a presidential nominee come from Texas? That's not president, that's nominee. And how many times, not people?
So, we can talk now, right?
LBJ.
We're a team.
LBJ twice.
The Bushes.
Well,
W. Bush.
Do the Bushes count?
Do both Bushes count?
I think they both count.
They both count? Okay.
Wait, was LBJ on the ballot twice or just once?
You guys all paid money for this. You realize that?
He would have been on the ballot once. Okay.
So it's 5. But are we forgetting someone weird?
Is it since a certain date?
Ever. Since Texas.
Okay.
When did Texas happen?
18...
Something.
Something.
I feel
but
like
there
the,
weren't a lot of Western...
Yeah. The audience is colluding. Listen to that din
All
of
right.
like... I mean, so we've identified 5, right? Okay, we're going to 5.
Wait.
Ding, 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 ding,
okay.
ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. Good teamwork.
So now it's audience 3, 538-1.
Come back.
Ross Perot.
Oh. Major party. Wait a second.
Wait.
Major party. He said major party.
Yeah.
Listen back on the podcast.
Come on.
All right, settle down. We did an audio documentary on Ross Perot, sir. Check it out.
Galen did, actually. Great documentary.
We'll give Perot
this is
too.
According to 538's official count as well. So it's not just me who would be wrong. It would be 538 as
major
a site.
Major party nominees.
All right. On to you, Claire.
He got up and bowed.
Welcome to Texas. All right, I guess this is to Claire, but also to everybody again.
Yeah.
According to the 538 endorsement tracker, which Democratic presidential candidate has the most valuable endorsement so far?
Single?
Single most valuable endorsement. Because, in case you're unfamiliar with our endorsement tracker, different people get different scores based on how prominent they are within the party.
I think it's Warren with a past nominee.
Who's a past nominee? Because Dukakis...
Yeah, Dukakis endorsed Warren.
But Mondale was a past vice president and endorsed Klobuchar.
So which is more...
I came up with a scheme.
Yeah, which is more valuable.
So you would think I would know. I'm pretty sure that Mondale's worth more than Dukakis.
All right.
So Klobuchar.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah. Come back.
All right, so Amy Klobuchar is in first with Walter Mondale's endorsement, which is worth 10 points. Biden, Booker, and Harris are tied for second with endorsements from the governors of their states, and that's worth 8 points.
The Mondale endorsement really is a game changer. So.
Great. I know. Should that really even count? He's worth as much as Obama.
Former vice president.
All right. Now on to Micah, although, again, everybody.
Team Micah.
When was the last time Travis County, the home of Austin, Texas, voted for a Republican for president?
Bush? W?
I would think it would have to be earlier than that.
You think
that.
Not Bush in 04? Bush is
That's
pretty popular.
Thought. That's what I thought.
This is a pretty liberal place,
everybody,
right?
Everybody, shh. Don't tell them the answer.
I don't know this one, so I would guess...
I mean, 04 is sort of the most obvious.
I think it's probably Bush.
All right, 2004.
Okay, audience.
84 was the first one.
No.
Yeah.
You're
How
all
does it
wrong.
Feel?
And we're in Travis County. Come on, guys. Although Austin is one of those places where, like, everyone's a newcomer, so none of these people were even here the last time that the county voted for a Republican, and it was only in 2000.
Oh.
So you were close.
Oh, okay.
So George W. Bush won in 2000. In 2004, he lost the county by 14
okay.
points.
Ooh.
Wow.
What happened
Swift
in between?
Change. I guess the war in Iraq, we could get into that one.
So all right. no so one it gets
is,
a point.
It is still audience 3, 538, 2. Now on, okay, here's another one, another Texas one. Back to Nate. According to Texas's 1845 annexation agreement with the United States, it is allowed to divide itself into up to how many different states?
Five, come on, dude.
I didn't. Well, that was so odd. Did that get you all that.
Know? No, Nate's a freak.
Was that? Does everybody know that?
Everyone knows that, don't
no.
they?
No.
We don't.
Okay, now it's a tie, and good thing we only have
winner take
one
all.
Question left.
Yeah, it's make it take it. So let's.
So, all right. This is a tricky one. We'll see how well you know your own website. So, throughout the primary so far, we've been writing pieces that describe each contender's path to the nomination, the Democratic nomination. It's a little insidery, but which candidate's article about their path to the nomination was read by the most people so far?
Pete Buttigieg did good.
Harris.
I don't know if that ever...
No, it's either the Biden one did really well, or Sanders, or it's like one of those first six.
Oh, I bet it's Sanders.
Harris?
I bet it's Sanders.
No, who was right before Harris?
Warren?
I think it's Warren, Sanders, or Biden.
Well, see, now you've fucked us up. Now you've given them...
I actually don't know. I don't...
I think it's...
Like a 1 in 2 chance of getting it right if we get it wrong.
I think it's Sanders.
I think it's
probably Harris, though.
Wait, Harris? You just totally switched?
It's going to be one you wrote.
I didn't write
okay,
Harris.
Three,
I wrote Biden.
Two,
Biden.
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 Ding, 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 ding.
What a comeback.
We invited you to our show so we could beat
it's
you
a
in
bit
trivia.
Like, it's a bit like winning the coin toss in overtime where the other team never actually gets possession of the ball. It's like a little rigged, but yeah.
A little rigged. That question could not have been more. You guys would have no chance of knowing that.
All right. Well, that is a wrap for trivia. Congratulations to you guys for beating the audience.
Shout out to the Perot guy.
We really managed to turn this audience against us really quickly.
That's a wrap for today's podcast. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
I hate going after Claire.
And thank you to the audience. Give yourselves a round of applause, the most important part. Again, if you want to come see us in Houston on Wednesday, head over to 538.com/live. My name is Galen Druk. A special thanks to Vanessa Diaz, our manager of business operations, who organized tonight's show. And thank you as well to Stephanie Roos, James Pierce, and Amber Gardner. And again, thank you to Ashley Lopez. Yeah. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store, or just tell someone about the show. Thanks for listening, and we will see you in Houston.